Live. This is the Dave Coleman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. If you want to join me, Erica 209-565. Dave is the text machine. Email is Dave at thedavecolemanshow.com. And of course, we're on the web. So for the Dave Coleman Show on Facebook and Twitter. Joining me now, David Nabham.
What's up, Whitey?
Hey, friends. Sorry. Still left stuff in the queue there, Dave. I'm still learning my way around this. Welcome back to the show, man. It's good to talk to you again.
Hey, it's been a while, but it's great to talk. Great to talk to you too, Dave.
I don't think
please accept your invitation to come on.
Yeah, I don't think we've talked since I left AM radio a couple of 3 years ago. So, other than on the internet, we talk all the time, but none of that. So, I had you on because I was reading. I've been working with Ben, my son, and we've been talking about. He's very concerned about these five mass extinction events, and one of those ones, the most recent one, the Permian-Triassic, was kind of initiated by something we're going to talk about today, which was a volcanic eruption that led to coal seam fires. Now, this happened 200 million years ago, something like that, killed off 90% of the planet's, life forms, and we've since obviously recovered and moved on and evolved into human beings and so forth and so on. But Ben is, worried about volcanoes. But now I'm reading your article yesterday, and I guess I just didn't make this connection. We still have coal seam fires burning on this planet today.
10,000 of them. 10,000.
How is that even possible?
Pumping out a billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every year, equal to, as I pointed out in the op-ed, equal to one-fifth of the entire carbon footprint of the United States of America, every car, every factory, every people, so interested in putting the kibosh on everything that we need to live and breathe and work and live and play, where there's, an easy way to attack something that doesn't require, jumping in the faces of industrialists or breaking the spine of civilization. You would think people would have long ago, first, before they did anything, said, hey, let's see at least if we can attempt to put out these coal seam fires. But you're right, there's 10,000 of them. Well, there might be more. Nobody, how would you know? They're all burning underground.
Well, that's, okay, so what's causing this? Let's start with that, because I'm always interested. How does a coal seam fire start?
Boy, that's a rough question. I'll try to give you the best answer. Any number of ways. Humans have started some of them, abandoned coal mines, stupidity. Nature has caused quite a bit of them, but through the help of man. Let's just focus in one area that I'm adept at answering. The greatest number of these coal seam fires are popping up in Indonesia, and the reason for that is the Indonesians are on a real rage right now. They're on a bend to the deforestation in Indonesia is quite astounding. They're chopping trees down like there's no tomorrow, and leaving giant bald spots. Lightning strikes all the time, and in the past, for millennia, for eons, it struck, and the world was covered with trees, and it never got to impinge on the coal seams beneath the ground. Now it's going straight through, there's no cover. It hits the ground, it continues into the coal seam, and lightning starts a lot of these, and they're popping up like wildfire. They are wildfire. They're popping up all over the place in Indonesia thanks to lightning strikes, thanks to deforestation.
So I guess in a way we could argue that the coal seam fires in many cases are kind of man-caused then.
I'm no expert on that. Like you said, they've been burning since there's been an Earth. There have been coal seam fires, but I would guess that man's hand found in so many things is found here too, and the Indonesian example is a good one. If it hadn't been for the great swaths of land that is now laid bare of those lightning strikes, they're obviously being started by lightning in Indonesia, and that lightning is being beckoned to strike thanks to the timber industry there. So make sure that I don't misstep, speaking only of Indonesia, that seems to be the case. Yeah, there's a heavy hand of humanity. The fingerprints of humanity are there, definitely.
You could kind of relate that, and you brought that up, and it kind of, this lightning thing kind of brings this up, and that is the fires, the forest fires, particularly in the western United States, California, Oregon, Washington, Canada, last year had a real bad one. that are also caused by lightning strikes, but it's kind of the reverse. In some ways, it's because we're not logging enough. We have our trees are dying because there's not enough water. There's too many of them. There's no balance here, is there?
You've touched on a very important subject, and you know there's a big brouhaha about that as well. The idea that, you know, we should leave the forest completely alone, do nothing. The activists have been calling for staying out of the forest and not burning and not managing and providing no stewardship. And you're right, that is a formula for the horrific wildfires that have broken out in the West. Now, there are people who dispute that, and I'm not a forest ranger. I have no dog in that fight since I moved out of California some time ago. But it's been with interest that I've seen these incredible fires raging, and I wonder, as you, if the lack of our stewardship over the land has something to do with that, allowing that brush to build up and doing all the things we used to do, including harvesting timber properly, I think may have contributed to some of these disasters over the recent years.
Well, and that's kind of the part of it. I mean, if you drive around here up in Washington, when you drive past a forest that's obviously timber, obviously lumber, you'll see very young trees, and it'll be a sign that say planted 2005. You'll see middle-aged trees, and then you'll see older trees. And it's obvious that they keep recycling it. They're clearly not doing that in Indonesia. Is that correct?
It doesn't seem to be that way. They're a few years ago, botanists were stunned at the number of trees that are. They counted the number of trees on Earth. I don't know if you saw that scientific abstract. They've determined there are 3 billion trees on planet Earth, which is three trillion trees on planet Earth. I misspoke. 3 trillion. 15 times the number of the stars in the Milky Way. Now, that's a lot of trees. And there used to be more. They estimate now with these new numbers that there used to be 6 trillion trees on planet Earth. It would be known as the tree planet, I guess, back in those days. There's 3 trillion trees on Earth, though, now. And people don't realize, you know, when you other species need trees to go sometimes. You can't have just a planet filled with trees. You need meadows. You need, you know, without open spaces, you don't have a varied biome, and many species have to go. So sometimes a tree going down is not such a bad thing.
I was going to say, from an evolutionary standpoint, it wouldn't. I mean, you can't have one species of anything dominate like that and be successful.
Right.
It would be
correct.
Be crazy. So back to these coal seam fires. You wrote this article to point this out. Not just that, but to point out the fact that nobody seems to care about this. Nobody seems to go, hey, here's a place where we could actually do something easily and cheaply and quickly, and nobody cares. Why?
Well, you know, you read through the, I didn't state that specifically, but I think you read, you know, you read through the fine print, and that's what I meant to say. You're right. And it's not that they're easy to put out. I only had 800 words, but, here in Pennsylvania, I live in Pittsburgh, and just a few years ago, Pennsylvania, EPA spent $1.5 million and put out a coal seam fire. For $1.5 million, it was burning under the Pittsburgh International Airport, or in around it. So it's not easy, but lately the technology has changed in such a way that what they're doing now is they're boring holes and pumping down fire extinguishing foam that not only sucks the fuel away, but it under pressure it pushes the oxygen away from the fire and snuffs it out. So they can be put out, but it's not easy, it's not cheap. But to the greater point, you're right. You tap any activist on the shoulder and, you know, ask him to hold off for a while and explain his stand on coal seam fires, and he'll look at you as if you're speaking a foreign language. They're more interested in the terrible industrialist who needs to be put out of business, you know, in order to save the world from the nasty carbon death that awaits us, or going after a source of CO2 that has no villainous human face doesn't seem to garner much attention. So activists don't even know coal seam fire exists. They're and the rub is, if years ago, if they had come to the public forum and told everyone, hey, we're going to try to marshal the world's government's resources and try to extinguish the planet's coal seam fires, and when we finish with that, industrialists, be advised, we're coming to snuff out your smoke too. You'd best, do something on your own while we're busy with these wildfires. See you in a couple of years. If they said something like that, they'd be, they have a real cachet. The general public might be more constrained to regard them as true heroes, but that's not what they've done. They've gone straight for the society's juggler, right to attempting to kill the agricultural, industrial, commercial, and military spine of civilization, and they've leapfrogged right over that obvious, easy, appropriate target, as you say.
Well, it kind of ties in with what I've been ranting about for half an hour, because I was supposed to talk about freedom of speech, and so I got on this rant about why do people want to believe the complicated, illogical thing as opposed to the logical, not so complicated, and it kind of ties in with that, and it all comes down to money, I guess, because they can get money to battle industrialists, but they can't get money to battle coal fires in a country that's going to laugh them off the borders if they try to get in there.
Well, and you said a mouthful there. This, the carbon taxes that our neighbors to the north, the Canadians have a carbon tax. There's a dozen countries in Europe that have a carbon tax. The Knoxville Sentinel was gracious enough to give me a few inches of their opinion page a few months ago, and I wrote an op-ed about the calls in Tennessee to place a carbon tax on steaks and barbecue. Just for this feel-good movement, I guess. But I think people are starting to recover from this hiatus in thinking that you're responding to, that you're referring to. And even in Canada, many people are screaming for a repeal of that, the carbon taxes. We're carbon-based life. For us to regard the carbon as a pollutant or CO2 is the piston of life. It's what powers photosynthesis. Every mouthful of food every human puts every spoonful of food that we all put in our mouths comes from carbon dioxide, water, and converted into simple sugars by sunlight. So if we were to rename Earth, it might be called Carbonia. Carbon is the most, it's certainly even more important to life than oxygen. Years before there was the first whiff of oxygen on this planet, there was a profusion of life. Without carbon, there is no life, period.
I brought you on to talk about coal seam fires, but it's my show, so we're going to drift away from that for just a minute. I want to go back to something. You bring up this carbon dioxide thing, and I want to go back to something that you got me into. Gosh, has it been a year now?
So I can read your mind. You want to talk about Haber process.
Haber-Bosch. You got me involved in a book called The Alchemy of Error, which I cannot highly recommend this book enough. Things I didn't know. I guess in the back of my brain I knew, but it's amazing to me, and it got me thinking, and I don't have my notes in front of me because I wasn't planning on going this direction, but it's amazing to me how this war on carbon dioxide is really less of a war on global warming and more of a war on food. It's an attempt to get rid of people.
Well, you bring up a very good subject there. And, I have enjoyed our exchanges back and forth about the Haber process, and I'm as interested in it as you are. I could certainly learn more about it, but if you want to go off on that tangent, there's a real crisis having to do with carbon dioxide and food, and it's not me speaking about it. Let me introduce your listeners to, may I take a moment to say something about food and carbon dioxide and the point you just made?
Go right ahead.
All right. Freeman Dyson was a young man, was a colleague of Albert Einstein's at Princeton when he was an old man, and he's currently considered one of the most respected physicists. Dyson spheres clusters, which astronomers look for around stars as indicators of alien life, are named after him. So he's the furthest thing there is from a lightweight. He's also very unconvinced that the uptick in CO2 has doomed the planet. Quite to the contrary, while he certainly, like everyone else, doesn't dispute the rise of CO2 from, what was it, 280 pp parts per million back in 1850 to 400 parts per million today, his point is that that might be the world saver rather than the world crusher. His focus is that the real dilemma on Earth that we're going to be facing very soon around 2050 is that the population is going to hit 10 billion. And if we intend to feed 10 billion mouths on this planet by that date, we're going to need to double the crops on Earth in 32 years. And that must sound like it doesn't just sound like a labor of Hercules. That is a labor of Hercules. And his point is that we can use all the help we can get, and it might just have come to us thanks to the very industry we're so busy at this moment trying to dismantle. As I mentioned, photosynthesis is the very piston of life and food, and plants using sunlight to convert carbon dioxide, you know, if you cut that back, you know, the less sunlight, the less food, the less water, the less food, and the less carbon dioxide, the less food. So I know people who scream, you know, I'm with science, They may not want to hear this, but carbon dioxide might be the key to making sure that millions don't starve by the middle of this century. So that's Freeman Dyson's his words, actually. He calls it a great blooming. He has noted that plants around the world, crops around the world, are responding to this increased ambience of higher CO2 levels, and that it's producing more food. So that's what one of the great physics laureates ever to walk the earth has to say about it, and I thought I would quote him about it.
You know, one of the other things CO2 does is it also puts out fires.
It also puts out fires. Yeah, you or nitrogen. They're using CO2 or nitrogen in some of those some of those techniques I was telling you about in boring the holes and putting out the coal seam fires.
It's pretty amazing to me, and I you got me on that book, and it actually, I'll tell you what it did, Dave, and that was, I actually went and got fertilizer for my lawn, and I actually greened up my lawn because I read that book, and I finally understood the process, and it's like, now I understand why back in the 70s people were putting cow manure on their lawns.
Half of your DNA is and half of my DNA, half of the fixed nitrogen in our DNA was created in ammonia factories. So that is a stunning. Most people wouldn't know that. Little things that aren't so little after all. The potato, for example. Two out of five people on the earth wouldn't be alive today without the introduction of the potato, when it was found, how it was found, and how quickly it spread across the world. So these processes, you know, we've constantly been told, and, you know, from Malthus's time, we've been constantly worried about the fact that, you know, sooner or later we have to crash, you know, 1 billion, 2 million, 6 billion, 7 billion, 10. When will the crash come? But people count out the amazing cleverness of Homo sapiens. Every time you think he's down for the count, he pops back up. You know, you just can't knock him down. The Haber process, as you keep referring, it saved the world around the middle of World War One. And there's been many GMOs, whether you like them or hate them or whatever. You know, a chicken doesn't look like a chicken used to. And corn, if you took a look at the Mexican grass back in pre-Aztec times, you wouldn't even, there's no way you could recognize it. Man has been fending off starvation since there has been man. And I'll put my money on the humans. I don't think we're going to starve to death, but back to what I said about Freeman Dyson, if there's anybody that can be called a genius, he's one of them. And people who call him a denier or, you know, well, no, I don't think anybody would dare to call him that to his face or even, you know, refer to him that way, but he is a denier, you know. He's worse than a denier. He says that carbon dioxide is not only isn't bad, that it might be good and it might be great. So You know, the scientific method should rule here. You know, we should get politics out of this, and that includes me. I have a political bent, as you well know, but I'm not so close-minded as to accept the reverse if it turns out to be true. And the only thing that saves us from going the wrong way is the scientific method. We have to put our opinions and policies to the side and demand proof.
How do we do that? How do we get the politics out of this? Because like you said, I mean, I've got a political bent, you've got a political, everybody has a political bent. How do we get it out of that?
Dave, you can't. Unfortunately, what happens usually is that disasters get politics out. People will be trundled off down the wrong path until millions die, and then they'll realize their mistake, and, you know, the pendulum will swing back. One would think that in the 21st century, that ridiculous paradigm would have, you know, people would have come together and said, that's, you know, that does work, but it's a bit costly. I'm certain that there was political infighting 400 years ago, 300 years ago. The scientific method's been with us for 500 years. And people want to imagine that Galileo and Newton and all those guys, you know, they were perfect paragons of you know, civility, and they never, you know, they only went with the scientific method. That's probably bunk, you know, because they were humans. But I don't believe in the history of science we've seen it so politicized as now. We're close to, you know, when people start calling for carbon deniers to be placed under arrest or that they're work should not be expressed in public. You know, that's about as close to Torquemada and the Inquisition as you'd want to get. I mean, yep. Don't put me in, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, play the victim card and put me with Galileo. And I'm not saying I'm a denier or an accuser or, you know, I'm for it or against it. I'm just interested, I'm interested in knowing what actually is going on. And at this juncture, while we're speaking and taking this agricultural bent that you've asked for, I'm interested in seeing that millions of people don't starve by 2050. There are going to be 10 billion mouths on planet Earth in just 32 short years, and somebody is going to have to figure a way to double our agricultural output. That sounds like a hell of a task to me. And if it requires actually saying, oops, we made a mistake, maybe CO2 isn't so bad after all, sorry. I mean, that's kind of hard after 30 years of screaming. That's why screaming's not such a good idea when you get into, you know, scientific debate. These screamers that have been screaming for 30 years that CO2 is the demon's gas, it's, you know, how do you backpedal on that?
It's hard to do.
It's hard
to change people's. That's one of the reasons why I've always enjoyed talking with Dave, going back to his earthquake books. You know, Dave is a scientist's mind, even if, you know, whatever. He approaches it with the, let's get facts and let's deal with that instead. So I would be remiss if I let you go without touching base on that real quick. How's the earthquake investigation stuff going?
Well, I'm now, as you know, a Newsmax insider columnist and one of a group that includes an astoundingly well-known and respected group of writers, and from mostly, I'd like to stress, left, right, and center, people like George Will, or Fareed Zakaria, Patrick Buchanan, Alveda King. So Newsmax is a great, unlike many journalistic outfits, I really have a lot of respect for them. They're great people. So it's a great honor to be among that group. So, and I write a weekly science column for them. And if your listeners want to get my column sent to their email free of charge, of course, just they can. The easy way is to just type in Shaking Up Science. That's the column. That's the title of my column, Shaking Up Science, you know, with earthquakes. And Newsmax, type that into the search field and I'll pop up. And for your listeners also who are interested in earthquakes, seismicity on the West Coast and the current state of earthquake prediction worldwide, just visit my my website at www.earthquakepredictors.com for quite a bit of information about that and links to my books and interviews and op-eds. And I would be my publishers would hate me if I didn't mention my current book out. Skyhorse Publishing in New York has released a few months ago my latest book on seismicity. It's Earthquake Prediction, Dawn of the New Seismology, and it's a compendium of all the dozen current most promising earthquake precursors and paradigms for seismic forecasting that are being researched all around the world by some unbelievably great physics laureates and great scientists and seismologists around the world, many of whom were kind enough and gracious enough to weigh in and allow me to use their comments in the book. So if anybody's interested in earthquakes on the West Coast, even though I wrote the book, I do recommend it. Earthquake Prediction, Dawn of the New Seismology.
It's pretty good stuff, so that's right. Dave, I'm out of time. I wish I had another 3 hours, but I don't. But always good to talk to you. And folks, check out his stuff, Shaking Up Science at Newsmax, as well as his books, and his science fiction books, too. So those are you're a man of many talents, Dave, and I appreciate you being here today.
I appreciate the time and trouble, and it's been a pleasure to have a word with your audience. Thanks again, Dave.
As always, my friend. We'll talk to you real soon.